Subcommittee on the Judiciary, January 14th, 1 p.m., room 350.
We'll start with Senate Bill 3 today. Representative Marsh.
Fingerprints had been of use in 10 cases of 1,000. The offices in Multnomah County, only one of which included such information in the actual trial. So in one trial of 1,000 youth, fingerprints were brought in as evidence. Multnomah and Washington County judges had reported that they received from 2 to 10 requests for fingerprinting juveniles each month, and that these requests are granted almost without exception at the present time. And then one last point, Judge Peel has pointed out that if the police have sufficient probable cause to take a juvenile into custody on felony charges, they also have sufficient evidence to secure a court order for fingerprints and photographs. That, in a nutshell, were the arguments that came to mind to the youth commissioners, and all of them obviously had some bearing on the position we took in opposition to the bill.
Questions of Representative Marsh? Representative Brown.
Representative Marsh, your statement here indicates that fingerprinting and photographing juveniles is not a matter of constitutional rights, as you see. How did it happen that Mr. Remington's organization is dedicated to the preservation of constitutional rights? Why would she call us a witness then? It's a friendly question. I've been a member of the ACLU since 1948. She and her organization, now my organization, are dedicated to the preservation of civil rights. This is not a question of civil rights.
I have to beg off. I simply do not recall how her name came up or why she was contacted as presenting an opposed
were any law enforcement authorities from Clackamas County, which I think is the third or fourth largest in most populous county in the state, called?
Not that I recall. We did have in the initial testimony an officer from the Beaverton City Police Department in Washington County, along with the officer Fonz from Portland.
You indicated that from fingerprinting there's a fear of an assumption of guilt. That was one of the
That was an argument cited before to the commission by Mrs. Remington.
I can't follow that point. You indicated a fear that expungement would not be surefire, so there was concern there. Again, it just seems to everything we did was out of fear that some other lawful process didn't occur, I think we're going to be in deep trouble.
I think if I recall correctly, there had been some situations with the computerized system in CRISP in the Tri-County area about the expungement of records through that. And apparently, as I understand it, the judge must order the record expunged. And it's done at that point. And there was some concern about the fact that some judges seem very slow in doing that. And sometimes there's a breakdown between the order and the process actually occurring.
And then you indicated that fingerprints in juvenile cases were only useful in 1 out of 1,000 cases. Might the nominal usefulness of the fingerprints be the fact that they're not available in maybe 999 cases?
They could have been available if the police had requested the judge to provide them. In other words, the police are not now using this very much as a technique. In other words, there are very few requests, as I pointed out here in Washington County. Washington and Multnomah both receive 2 to 10 requests per month from police agencies asking that this be permitted. So it's not a terribly common practice now. Although the commission believes there's plenty of latitude in the current statute to give the police the option of going to get that information if they want it. That is the photograph of it.
Further questions? Senator Roberts. Since this has come primarily from City of Portland, is there, are the juvenile judges there more reluctant to give permission to the police than other places?
I'm not sure. I know that Mark Kelly, who's representing the City of Portland in favor of this measure, would probably be able to answer that question better. Because it's easier if you don't have to go to the judge.
It's easier.
Do it on the spot.
And do you think that they would like to do it a lot more than they are now?
That's the impression we got from the city of Portland.
And what impression did you get about the way this would be done? I hate to ask a leading question, but isn't it your impression that at least some police officers would like to photograph and fingerprint a whole bunch of kids that they sort of suspect are bad kids and committing crimes? And if they can get them in there for some reason, it may not be directly an investigation of some real serious crime, but if it's easy to do, they would like to be able to have a lot of people's fingerprints and photographs on file that are in a population that they consider to be criminal.
I'm not sure what the commission's reaction to your question would be. That was not specifically discussed, nor do I recall that question being asked specifically of Officer Funt of the Portland Police Department. I would just have to, you know, talk off the top of my head. I don't get the feeling that that the police are out to make trouble for anybody. That there's some kid that they don't like, and therefore they're going to haul him in on some false pretense so that they might secure their photographs and fingerprints. I don't see this as an attempt to hassle young people. Personally, I don't. I think that their request is, from their point of view, a legitimate request, and they feel apparently it's going to provide them a tool that'll help make the process of trying and convicting suspected felons easier.
I'm not that familiar with juvenile law. It says if a child is taken into custody for the commission of an act, and Representative Marsh made the point that you'd have to have probable cause in order to do that. You have to have probable cause for an arrest, but do you have to have probable cause to take a juvenile into custody? For an act? Is it standard the same?
Yeah.
Okay.
Further question? Representative Marsh and Jerome Wade and me, do you think there's any fiscal impact and stuff?
Never even thought about it. I wouldn't see any.
The mayor of Portland would say if we passed this, that this is a mandated service and they come down here to get money in order to carry out the program.
I'm not going to speak for Mayor Goldschmidt.
Thanks for the question. Thanks.
Did the commission talk about have any testimony about what the effect on young people, what effect it has on young people being fingerprinted or photographed, as far as their own attitude towards them?
Yes, we were very concerned about that. The fact is, I gave that as an argument that many people who are on the receiving end of that assume that this is tantamount to guilt. I don't think for, let's say, a person 15 years old and who has throughout their life seen many situations on TV where, you know, they're in the police station and the suspect, the killer, the person who just looted or robbed, is fingerprinted, and my God, here they are in this police station. brought in on suspicion of doing something, and they're being fingerprinted just like any old common criminal. And that was a real concern to the Youth Commission, the attitude that's planted there. And I talk about it as a stigma factor.
Linda Brown.
Mark, was there any testimony from any youth that
the Salem Youth Commission?
No, any youth, any young people that they would feel stigmatized. When I was a youth at 12, every member of my Boy Scout troop was fingerprinted for purposes of identification. Every boy went to the troop for years and years. If you would ask me, you would take it. My fingerprints were on file with the FBI as of age 12, and I none of us felt stigmatized. So maybe I
but
that
was based on in the context of loyalty to your country, I expect, the Boy Scout, not in so much as in a police station being fingerprinted. Two different kinds of attitudes conveyed there.
Well, our Boy Scout master had to be a chief of police. He also felt that.
We should have figured that out.
He felt that this is what you call preventative law enforcement. That if our bodies were found somewhere, they could find us, and if our fingerprints were found on the windowsill of a school, it would have a chastening effect.
Yeah.
You've just given the answer that I tried to get him to give, and he wouldn't give.
I wondered why he always came up with these strong law and order bills. He's always coming up with.
You must have been a service training.
I might go on with your comment, Senator. We did have a young man there who was representing the Salem Youth Commission. They had considered the bill, that group of high school age students in this area, and they had opposed it, and he conveyed that on to the commission. So a young person, I believe he's a junior or senior in high school then, from the young person's point of view, was relating that. And we also have some young people on the commission as well. Thank you.
Jay Ruff from the Department of Motor Vehicles, and maybe I should apologize, first of all, for not being more prepared than I am, but I only found out about an hour ago that I was going to have to come up and testify in regards to Senate Bill 161, so I don't...
I'm sorry, we're on Senate Bill 3.
I signed up for 161.
Well, I guess, Jay Ruff?
Yeah.
I think you signed the wrong sheet. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
I'll put you on the right sheet if you don't mind.
Sure, thank you.
Sorry. Don Welsh.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Don Welsh. I'm the director of the Clackamas County Juvenile Court. I am here representing the Oregon Juvenile Court Directors Association and speaking in favor of the bill. To give further context to my comments, I might observe that I've spent the bulk of my adult professional life working in the juvenile court. But there is also the overlay of having spent a year as a prosecutor and a comparable amount of time being a defense attorney in both the juvenile court and the adult criminal court. We are in support of the measure that's been submitted, and that is a shift in position from a position we have assumed over the years. And there are reasons for that shift. I think it's important to know what this issue is and also what the issue is not. In the main, this is not a question of whether it is or is not easy to get permission of the juvenile court judge to get fingerprints. And further, as our, in our view, it's not a question of whether it is simple in the course of a court process to use fingerprints for purposes of conviction or whether that's frequently done. The real issue to us is the question of whether a crime investigative tool, which has demonstrated its usefulness for years as a professional law enforcement officer to testify better than I, whether that should be denied to the police solely because the defendant or the suspect is a juvenile. And we submit that the issues which would have in the past mitigated against the use of that kind of information have been addressed, and perhaps more than addressed, even solved. The lament that we've heard so often in terms of what the juvenile court does or does not do centers on the proposition that given that a child misconducts himself, the system does not seem to gear up and somehow provide the treatment that is appropriate to his needs and society's needs. But I've never heard the argument seriously offered that it is not significant and important and worthwhile for society to respond to somebody's illegal behavior. Simply the argument is turned on the question of whether our response is effective in the treatment category. I'm sure there are police officers who will talk about how important it is for a police officer to be able to use fingerprints as a source of identification to tell us what sorts of children are in the community for whom we have cause to be concerned. And they'll further state, I'm confident, that a fingerprint is available to them as an investigative tool in a manner which no other kind of evidence is generally available. That is, it is technical, it is precise, it is not subject to someone's judgment, and it is a reasonable means of determining whether a person you have under suspicion is or is not probably the individual you should be taking into custody. Well, then why have we objected to this in the past? In the main, if you reflect on the present juvenile code and its restrictions in terms of confidentiality of information, under 419.567. There has been a substantial argument about whether that confidentiality extended to police records. Those of us who felt it did were able to get a very shaky Attorney General's opinion in accord with our position. But it was not uncommon for us to find situations where, in our view at least, police departments misused the information they had about a child. That is, it was distributed in perhaps some of the styles that Representative Marsh made reference to, that employers may have been interested, not only interested, actually had access to that data, something which all of us decried. Those reasons, for instance, that were involved in our decision to resist putting juvenile records on the data bank of CRIS and so on. The present Article 16 of the proposed juvenile code makes abundantly clear that a police record which involves a juvenile record first and a police record second, and that the sanctions which are available to the juvenile court judge to control how that information is disseminated relate exactly as much to a police officer as they do to anyone else, and that an abuse of the dictates of that section are cause for dismissal. That's why we're in favor. We're in favor because unless we know a kid is out there, we can't deal with it. We may argue about whether we deal well with him, but certainly we can't deal with him at all unless he's identified. As long as the curbs on the use of the information exist, then I fail to see the distinction between a burglary report, a field investigation report, a witness identification, subjective information that it is, and the other tools that police officers presently use to identify suspects and to bring the matter before the court. In other words, so long as the material is subject to the same rigors and controls that the rest of the materials about a juvenile are subject to, then there is little purpose in making a distinction between a fingerprint and any other kind of investigative tool. And at least from my perspective, I think that the opponent probably should be assaulting the other less substantial and substantive forms of evidence, which are in their own style more invidious than fingerprints. If you consider the fact that fingerprints are specific and clearly identify given people as opposed to the mere suspicions and surmises of people, which are presently the kind of things that one finds in a burglary report perhaps, and nobody seems to complain about the police being able to rely on that data. Further, the arguments we heard this morning, in keeping with Senator Brown's observation, seem to turn on the idea that guilt, that arrest equals conviction, and a fear that expunction won't be complete. Well, we all know as lawyers that fingerprinting does not equal guilt. We also know that arrest is not equal to conviction. I sometimes get the feeling that we're being called upon to apologize to individuals who are being brought into custody for having brought them into custody, which frankly offends me in the sense that the system is, after all, designed to deal with their behavior. But in any event, we cannot make legislation on the basis of an assumption that a mandated process is going to be ignored. And that was the thrust of what we heard this morning, in my estimation. We stand convinced that a police officer's statement that a fingerprint is a valuable investigative tool is a legitimate one. This bill, as it is written, makes clear that it will not be possible for a police officer to go out in the style that perhaps Senator Wires was alluding to, of fingerprinting and photographing at will. Clearly, there is a need under the present language of this proposal for there to be a child who is already taken into custody pursuant to a felony charge. That means that it cannot just be a fishing expedition. And finally, I'm impressed by the statistics which were offered in terms of the ease of getting a judge's consent. But I would ask the question, if judges give their consent every time it's asked, why is it necessary to get the consent? It seems a pro forma act. Therefore, the process is legitimate as a law enforcement tool. Any criticism which could be used to say that the information is abused by police has been addressed, and I submit we should not frustrate ourselves in the efforts to bring people to our attention who might otherwise continue to misconduct themselves.
Questions, Mr. Wells, Senator Kapoor.
Don, subsection 5 talks about expunction. This means after, what are the grounds for expunction of the record?
It depends on whether you talk about the law today or the proposal, because there is a modification. But presently, a person who has been brought before the juvenile court, and if you remember from our testimony yesterday, 90% of those matters are dealt with informally. A person who turns 18 and was not formally brought before the court, as a matter of right, will have his record expunged. And expunction means an order from the juvenile court extending to any agency which is known to have any aspect of his record, directing them to destroy that record.
But that's done on request, right?
No. Present law is that that is done automatically as to those persons not brought within the jurisdiction of the court. A person who is brought within the jurisdiction of the court, that is, a petition is acted on, an adjudication is had, and a disposition made by the judge, 2 years after his, let us say, dismissal from the court process, that is, the completion of the terms of the order, presuming that he has not been involved in a crime involving moral turpitude, and he is not then being charged with a crime, he has a right to move the court for an order of expunction. The expunction is a matter of absolute right so long as he does not have that, have a record during those 2 years.
Yeah, terminology I'm not familiar with. When you come under jurisdiction, does that mean he's... What point does that mean?
If a burglary report is submitted to us, we can act on it formally or informally. If a petition is filed and the matter goes to court, then that is a formal matter, and that's how I refer to the matter coming within the jurisdiction of the court.
Okay, I suppose the guy, you think he's guilty, and he comes under jurisdiction of the court, and he's found not guilty.
Right.
Or somebody else that did it. Is his record that time automatically expunged, or is he wait 2 years to expunge?
That record is subject to immediate expunction, but not automatic expunction.
Yeah, that's something I'm concerned about, because it gets back to generally what we're talking about, the whole issue of having attorneys, because a kid is not going to know that he has a right to expunction, right?
And yes, he does know that. Part of the process is repetitive information in terms of what his rights to expunction include. And the court can order an expunction on its own motion also. So that what the details, to the extent that the bill is the expunction law is understandable, and that's debatable, the rights the child has pursuant to that legislation are made known to him at several stages in the proceeding.
As a matter of fact, how many or what percentage of mistakes where you pitch the wrong kid, I realize there are probably not many of those, but are they automatically, are they expunged? Do we have on our books now records where through ignorance or sloppiness, things are not expunged?
This is going to sound self-serving, but I don't remember having brought a case to court where we didn't make the case, so I can't use examples for you. Somebody else may have the experience. I simply do not.
So we're talking about a situation which doesn't exist?
Statistically doesn't exist.
You don't remember bringing a case to court where you didn't make the case? What about a case where someone becomes a material witness and the petition is dropped against him? Do you remember cases where that happened?
No.
The motorcycle is stolen and it ends up in possession of another young man, the boy who steals the motorcycle, takes it over to someone else's home. Another youth's home and leaves it there, and the boy who originally stole the motorcycle is charged, and the boy who ended up with the stolen property ends up telling the court about having received the stolen property, and the petition against him is dismissed.
I don't remember that fact situation.
Well, it happened in your department within the last year. It didn't occur to me at the time. I was representing the boy who ended up with stolen property. It didn't occur to me at the time to ask about expunction, but it seems to me that would be a case where he received stolen property.
In my estimation,
he was being investigated for that. A petition was brought against him for that.
Regardless of whether a petition was filed or not in that instance, it would be my interpretation, unless there was a motion for expunction, either by the court or by someone else at the time of the hearing, in our file system, 2 years hence, that matter would be subject to an automatic expunction because he was not found within the jurisdiction of the court, and thereby has a right, an absolute right, after reaching his 18th birthday for an automatic expunction. There is no system available which would deal with the matter at the time of the hearing. At least I'm not aware of one. And the other thing I would suggest, which is the source of concern to us, to a lot of us, is that the expunction statute as it is presently written confuses a good number of people. And what I'm describing to you as a process in Clackamas County may or may not operate in some other county.
Well, speaking of various counties, you mentioned that you didn't think that what I had mentioned talking with earlier with Representative Marks that would happen March, the fishing expedition. What about, you mentioned different counties just now. Wouldn't you think that in a county where there was less professional police, there might be more of a tendency for that to happen than in a county where the police were highly trained and so forth?
I can't respond to that except in the general idea that we can always assume that when there's less training, there's less efficiency. And therefore, I suppose it's a possibility. But that begs the question, because that's possible today. And that same police officer can come before the court setting forth what he considers the basis for reasonable cause for fingerprinting. And the experience that we've heard about so far is that those requests are uniformly granted.
Well, you say there couldn't be a fishing investigation. Fishing expedition, but under Section 1C, if a child is taken into custody for the commission of an act, which has been a felony if you were an adult, if there's been a burglary or some serious crime in a community, say a small rural community, and there's a population of kids in that community who are generally considered by the police to be the people who are committing the felonies that are being committed, let's assume that for the sake of the fact there are felonies being committed there, like burglary, and a burglary happens in that community, what is to stop the police from going and picking up those kids and bringing them in with the legitimate belief that they have committed the felony and fingerprinting and photographing all of them under this law?
The same thing to stop them from bringing them in today, and that is probable cause, which is administered after the fact, perhaps in the cold gray dawn of Monday morning in the courtroom. But that same complaint and argument then is available to say that nothing that the police do should be done without the consent of the judge, that they shouldn't be able to submit a child to the booking process or write a burglary report which includes his name. What you're suggesting is that we should narrow the field of what the tools available to a police officer includes because we worry that he will abuse them. And I find myself saying that that is scant rationale for mandating what the powers of the police will be. That should be addressed in terms of training of police officers. It's in the nature of writing legislation to deal with the fear that we have bad judges. It isn't responsive to the issue, in my estimation.
Well, you say that we should look to other things that are bad, but really there's just this particular thing in front of us right now. And you say probable cause. On that point, in adult court, people say that maybe we should have things. The question is whether it should be different for a juvenile. In adult court, if you're brought in and it turns out that there wasn't probable cause, there are occasionally suits. Have you ever seen in a juvenile situation a suit brought after the fact by someone who was brought in for less than probable cause?
Yes, we're presently defendants in such litigation.
Yeah.
The question is, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Kelly?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Kelly, and I appear before you this morning, this afternoon, representing the City of Portland. I'll make my remarks very brief, just expressing the sentiment of our city council. And I will turn the conversation over to Detective Gary Fonts from the Juvenile Division Felony in the City of Portland. As several members of this committee are aware, this particular issue was discussed during the interim period by the Interim Committee on Judiciary and is now before you as an interim committee bill. The council believes the decision of the interim committee was very wise, and the introduction of this bill was a good idea, and they have unanimously endorsed it. The council does not view this measure as a quantum leap forward in the apprehension of juveniles, but rather as a well-established tool which helps convict those who have committed felonies. As an urban environment that faces an alarmingly increasing number of juveniles who are committing felonies within our inner city, we believe it is extremely important that the police be given sufficient latitude bring those juveniles to court and to, in fact, extract convictions if they are guilty. With the expungement, as it is written into the proposed law, and with the protection of the juveniles' records of not going into any type of regional system, the City Council firmly believes that this piece of legislation is very much in the best public interest. And I think with those opening comments, with the permission of the Chairman, I'd just like to turn it over to Detective Fonts.
Thank you.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I appeared here before on this issue.
You want to state your name for the record, sir?
I'm sorry, ma'am. Gary Edward Fonts, F-A-N-T-Z. I am a police detective with the City of Portland, and I work the juvenile felony detail. I have some prepared testimony, which I will leave when we're finished here, that you can refer to later if you care to. The direction of the court, and to ensure the rights of individuals, law enforcement agencies have been ordered to rely more heavily on scientific investigation. The use of fingerprints and photographs are the most practical scientific means of identification. A vast amount of statistical data show that juvenile involvement in crime is at an all-time high. There is a very real need today for increased ability to identify juvenile offenders more quickly and more efficiently. Certain crimes, particularly burglary, auto theft, assault, armed and unarmed robbery, are very numerous among juveniles. Often the best means available in these crimes for identification of the offenders is through fingerprints and or photographs. Present law limits the fingerprinting and photographing of juveniles to a court order or transfer situation. Present procedural restraints reduce the overall ability to utilize these scientific methods to their most productive potential. Our proposed Senate Bill 3 provides a greater usage while still protecting the rights of those involved. Now, I do have some statistics, and I also have some copies of some Multnomah County juvenile court orders 144 court orders. Well, I'll take that back. 144 individuals, juveniles, were photographed or fingerprinted. There were actually a lesser number of orders because some orders would have several different juveniles' names on it because of the multiple situations involving the crime. 128 youths were fingerprinted or fingerprinted and photographed. And other 16 were just photographed only for a total of 144. Now, our criminalistics division...
Just a minute. How many times were you turned down by the judge?
I was not turned down any time last year.
Do you know of anybody that was?
Quite frankly, I do not. However, the people I work with in my office, we all know what the ground rules are for retaining one another. And unless we feel that we have all the sufficient information, we don't even ask. Because of course, time is coming. So getting turned down isn't a problem we have because we know where we stand.
Madam Chairman?
The undercook.
What are the conditions under which you apply and under which you know you can get a fingerprint order?
For example, Senator, if a burglary occurs, there's a burglary report taken. In the course of the initial investigation, there are fingerprints found at the scene of the burglary, and also there's been a youth taken into custody, either at the scene or in close proximity, almost in one immediate act. For example, a person getting caught inside a house. And we have fingerprints in that case. We can ask the court, we do ask the court for a court order, so we can take these fingerprints and compare them against those at the scene, be sure they're his, maybe there was somebody else in there that got out of there before police got there. This is one way we get a fingerprint order. Then these prints are used by the criminalistic people. They search of their files, and often other cases show up where these fingerprints are discovered in other burglary, most often burglary. We had, out of 157 cases made on juvenile prints last year by our department, there were 94 of these that were as a result of multiple mixes. 24 juveniles involved in more than one case. And the ones that were involved in more than one case where the fingerprint showed up in other places, it averaged out to 3.92, almost four cases. Yeah. This is what we're ultimately talking about. What Mr. Welch said about we can't do the kid much good until he's somehow plugged into the system. Through our experience working the street, working in nothing but juvenile felons, myself and the other people I work with in our office, so we have a pretty good idea that there's a whole number of youth in the community that are committing felons. They need to be taken and plugged into the court system so the system can try to change this. Often these are youth that have been taken into custody on numerous occasions for felony crime, that there was not sufficient reason at that point to ask the court for a fingerprint order or a photograph order. I personally feel very strong about this. We can't do the kid any good until we plug him in somehow. And I don't think that there's enough of this thing yet. It's pretty easy for an experienced law enforcement officer or an investigator to know a lot of things that are going on in the community, and pretty accurately, so you believe very strongly, but it's the kind of information that you obviously can't act on, and it probably will cause situations. I think this would be a very legitimate tool that would reflect some of the things that we already know.
How would you use, or are you going to testify to this, how would you use the fingerprint other than in those instances you've just described where you feel strongly enough about it that you seek an order? What other uses would you have for these fingerprints?
out a stack of fingerprint cards that are put on plaques and then scan through these to see if they can make a match. And I might add that our people are very good at this. We have several people that this is all they do, working on the police. And where we have obtained juvenile fingerprints through court order, we're finding more and more that we're discovering that these people that are involved come through our attention are going to be involved in other things too, very many cases. We think it's valuable to learn about this. Whether we ultimately charge them with the crime or not, to make this information available to the court so they have an accurate history to face their adjudication on.
Yes. To be useful to you, you'd have to have some kind of fairly universal system in order to get at, in order to retrieve this information, wouldn't you? And you'd have to keep it for quite a while, too. What I'm saying is, if you're going to get this kind of information, shouldn't it be, I don't know if they use computers with fingerprints. Do they use computers with fingerprints?
I understand that they are available and they're very expensive and we don't have one, although we wish we did.
What I'm saying, though, you'd have to have a pretty good system in order to discover these masses, wouldn't you?
Well, like I say, they're classed and subclassed down to where they can, not working with the principal itself, I'm not so sure I can accurately answer that, except our people do make matches all the time. And the more they do it, the better they get at it.
What percentage? It seems like I read some figures the other day that only a very small percentage of all crimes involve fingerprints. Is that right, or do you know?
I'm afraid I can't answer that. Working primarily burglaries, we do get a lot of cases where there are fingerprints and burglaries. I don't know the percentage.
Mr. Kelly, did you have an answer to that?
On the total percentage? I don't have an answer. I'm writing it down.
Do you have any idea?
Not overall. Not on all crimes committed. We'll find out.
Put it closer. Send it down.
Do young people who are involved on occasion in felonies ever end up as themselves victims of crime, where this might be helpful for purposes of identification of those people as, in other words, are they able to, your ability to obtain the name and address of a otherwise unidentified homicide victim?
This could certainly be an example. In fact, we had an example just like that in Portland not too long ago where the young girl homicide victim, we were several weeks in identifying her. There's a potential that we could have had her prints on file possibly. I don't know. That's kind of a hard thing to answer, but it's a possibility, certainly.
Further question. Senator Kapoor.
Yeah, the second half of Senator Cook's first question, he asked you, his first question, under what circumstances could you get a court order? And the second question is, under what circumstances could you not get a court order, but which you could get the fingerprints of the bill were enacted?
Where there is a, under the section C here, where it states that the child is, if a child is taken into custody for commission of an act which, if committed by an adult, would constitute a felony, and the child's photograph and fingerprints need to complete the investigation of the crime. We feel that this section provides for an extension of existing law to expedite the process. Time is an important factor for accurate identification, and it's our intent in this section that would provide us access to the scientific means of identification for the continuing use of determining juvenile criminal involvement.
In other words, now, it's a hassle to go to the court, and you're eliminating this hassle, but in terms of the number of kids who actually would be in reality fingerprinted, that wouldn't change. There wouldn't be different circumstances under which kids would be.
No, there would be more printed.
Like, what's an example of a kid who would be printed if this law passed, who is not now because you can't get the court, or couldn't get the court to go along?
don't even ask the court for an order. There's a time consumption thing. We're really quite busy. The juvenile crime flowing through our office is outstanding, and we have to kind of pick and choose where we're going to stop and start in on this other process to get these orders.
For the question. Thank you very much. Betsy Wells. I'm Director of the Office of Justice Programs for the City of Portland. I have a prepared statement that I can say beforehand. A lot of the points, of course, have already been covered, and I would just like to make some comments about some other approaches to the issue. It might be appropriate, as to those members of the committee that I don't know, to say that I'm an attorney. I've spent approximately 5 years as a prosecutor in the juvenile court in Multnomah County. I've also been involved in criminal justice planning for the City of Portland for on and off about 4 or 5 years. And it's more in the context of that second job that I'd like to make some further comments. I think you've gotten a pretty good description of the process and the issues within the juvenile court system itself. In 1972, as you may recall, Portland was selected to be an impact city. That was LEAA's $20 million per city program to try to fight burglary and stranger to stranger street crime. And the initial reaction when Portland was selected to participate in that program is, how is it possible for this particular city that we don't look upon as being a particularly crime-ridden metropolis to have the second highest burglary rate in the United States of cities over 250,000? We didn't believe it. And frankly, some of the people in the Department of Justice didn't believe it either. But that's what the UCR report shows. And we approached the process of planning for the expenditure of those funds with an eye to trying to figure out why it is that our statistics seem to be so high. There was some suspicion that we had an unusually high reporting rate, that the confidence in police was higher and people reported more burglaries, and therefore the rate was higher. That didn't bear out. Victimization studies were done. The reporting rate is not unusually high in Portland. I don't have any more answer now than we did the first day why Portland has such a tremendous burglary rate, and it still continues to have a very high one. But the one thing that we discovered in the process of planning and analysis of data at a level that's never been done before or since in this state was the very high incidence of involvement of juveniles. And this is on a comparison with other cities of our size around the country. The involvement of juvenile offenders is very, very high. 65% on residential burglaries, clear residential burglaries. I think it was on that basis that I first came to the conclusion that we had to do something along the lines of what this bill proposes. I don't see it as being a particularly dramatic shift because we do fingerprint and photograph youngsters now. It's a matter, it seems to me, of trying to strike a better balance between the interests of the public and the protection of juveniles. And it all makes sense to me within the context that the most important thing about the juvenile system, that which makes it different from the adult system and which must be preserved, is that concept of confidentiality. If the confidentiality is not preserved, there is no reason to have a separate system. But if you have confidentiality, there are certain things that you should be able to do within those limitations to identify kids and identify them, for what's really going on. In the material that I presented, there is a rundown of what the law is in the other states of the country. I want to make some qualifying statements because the search of the statutes was done about 2 years ago, and it may be that that there have been some changes, but you'll see about page 3 that I've run down and told you about how many states have laws of various kinds. The conclusion that you can draw from that, and I'm not trying to correlate it with crime rates or anything like that, is that we are not unique, but certainly in a minority, in having the kind of restriction that we presently have in the law. Those other states that adopted the same model, fundamentally model act that was adopted in 59, Missouri, a couple of the other states have the same fingerprinting provision, but it's somewhat unusual. I think maybe the
the other points have probably been covered in other
questions.
Chairman
Smith.
The percentage of the statewide juvenile crime problems you have.
I couldn't answer that. I could certainly check on it for you, but I don't know.
So whatever that percentage is, I'll give you that percentage.
That doesn't sound promising.
Good question.
Senator Kapoor.
Betsy, section D, having to do with consent. We've been talking here about consent, and are going to continue to talk about consent of juveniles, whether juveniles can or ought to be allowed to give consent. I wonder if you could discuss whether you think it's appropriate to allow a juvenile to give consent to your fingerprint.
I wish you'd asked my predecessor that question as well, so that you could have gotten a description from the police of why they consider this provision to be valuable to them.
I think that's fairly obvious.
Personally, I have some reservations about it. And a question that I would ask, perhaps at the committee address to someone from law enforcement, is whether that kind of procedure is available with adults and whether it is used significantly with adults. In other words, does a policeman who is not yet prepared to make a probable cause arrest go out to a suspect and say, "Why don't you come in and help us clear this up?" And what kinds of issues surround doing that with an adult? I'm sure it might be done in an isolated situation. I have no faith in the notion that a parent adding his consent, his or her consent, to the consent of a child is very meaningful. And so I have some reservations about this. It would seem to me that together with the authority to photograph a fingerprint in the event of a probable cause felony arrest, and the residual going back to the judge in any other situation, that the territory would be covered pretty well. I would say that particular provision makes me a little bit nervous. The example that's been given to me of where that would be useful is in a situation of a child is being accused by others of having been involved in some kind of unlawful behavior, and it would appear that a technique of this sort would clear it up. And police are not particularly focused in on this kid as an offender, and perhaps sort of as a dispute settlement device, as it was described. I'm not sure I'd make a particularly good advocate for that description of that point of view.
Pretty presentable case has been made for fingerprints, but nothing's been said about photographs.
I think that there is an important distinction to be made there, frankly. The area, of course, in which photographs are more important are in the robbery area, per se, those kinds of crimes. It's a useful, valuable investigation technique to be able to present a victim, obviously, with a series of pictures, and that includes in it the known juvenile offender. I think if you fall back on the basic principle that Don stated, the idea of giving the police a device that's proven useful and effective and appropriate. The advantage, of course, of fingerprints is that they are so reliable. They have a level of reliability that sort of puts them in a class by themselves.
Further questions?
Well, doubt in your mind that if this law were passed, that
photographs and probably fingerprints on most of the population in any given community that was believed by the police to be people who were committing crimes.
Well, I don't...
Over a period of, after it had been in effect 2 or 3 years, and there'd been an opportunity to bring them in on this or that legitimate investigation.
Well, with the qualification of the final part of your question, I would agree that as a result of appropriate arrest, lawful ones anyway,
which might or might not be involved with. We heard testimony that if they were allowed to, they would fingerprint people for when they were investigating them with a crime where they had no fingerprint evidence. Did you hear that a few minutes ago?
I didn't. I'm not sure what you said.
That evidence was given. That if there weren't any fingerprints in the case, they'd still like to, if they were legitimately investigating this kid for that case, even though there weren't any fingerprints in the case, they'd like to be able to fingerprint the kid. Don't you think that goes to the business that the people that are in a suspect class based on their behavior would turn into a set of files and photographs and fingerprints?
I can understand why you're saying that. I was in the DA's office of the juvenile court when we developed the procedures that are basically reflected in those affidavits and motions and so forth that the detective provided to you. And the circumstance under which that's likely to happen, in my experience with the orders, is that a juvenile or juveniles are arrested either in the course of a burglary or as they're leaving it. And they're taken into custody and they indicate responsibility, or the evidence is very strong just from the observation of the police officer who's signing the affidavit, that these kids were involved in that particular burglary, and fingerprint testimony there, is not really the issue there at all. But the assertion that we make to get the order to fingerprint in a situation where we've already basically got that crime cleared is that other crimes of the same, performed in about the same manner in the same vicinity have been committed. They remain unsolved, and there's reason to believe that because there were latent prints of those other crimes, that these kids should be printed. I think that's legitimate. That doesn't frighten me.
That's
I think true. That's the situation that
kind of got back.
Let me, for my own purpose, not clear this up, identify for me what you believe taking him into temporary custody.
In the instance of a temporary custody, certainly.
It has to be a formal kind of thing, doesn't it?
Yes.
So you can't haphazardly walk around the neighborhood and you know there are 5 bad kids there and you haul them in one day and you say, now I'm going to take your photograph and your fingerprint. If the 5 bad kids were involved in a burglary and they were arrested on site or by some reason, then they're in temporary custody, and they may, at that point, if this is still passed, photograph and fingerprint. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Further questions? Senator Wyers.
You mentioned that the main difference you saw here was between juveniles and adults in a matter of confidentiality. Were you excluding intentionally, or did you just kind of forget about the testimony about stigma, the effect that it has on young person's attitude about themselves?
I've thought about that a great deal, Senator Wyers. I think that there's some truth in the proposition that if you say in the process of arresting, because that's an underlying fact under this procedure, we worry about saying to a kid, you're a criminal, you're a delinquent, because they may hear it and may have some undesired effect. And that does concern me, and I think it is a consideration, and there's no arguing about it, there's a consideration. I'm not sure how much independent significance it has from the fact of being arrested, but it probably has some. I think the other side of that is just as important, and that is I've been around as a prosecutor several times when a juvenile has been printed, and their attitude about being printed is they are sobered by it. and I think that that has some potential that I'd like to see, and that's why I'm a supporter of this bill. I think kids see it as being sort of above negotiation and above argument. Their print matches a print in a burglary. That's it. Now, and if we hope that to deter behavior, I think that this is the one tool that we have not made full use of with juveniles.
So you're saying you think the therapeutic effect of the guilty kid having the fingerprint might be outweigh the bad effect it might have on a kid who was fingerprinted who might not be either guilty of a crime or might be quite immature, have an immature attitude to anything. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm not sure I want to put an absolute value on each one and say how it comes out, but I am saying I think that's at least a countervailing consideration, and because we do have provision for expungement, and because it is I think, a good protection for the kind of kid you're talking about, who is not involved, that we have to begin to give a little bit more consideration to our spiraling crime rate and to the fact that the representation of children in that activity is also spiraling.
Thank you very much. Julie McFarland.
Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee, I'm Julie McFarland, and I'm here today representing the Metropolitan Youth Commission of Portland and Multnomah County in opposition to Senate Bill 3. Under present Oregon law, neither the fingerprints nor a photograph of a child taken into custody is allowed to be taken except with the consent of the juvenile court or where the case has been remanded to the adult criminal court for prosecution. The Youth Commission has no quarrel with mugging and printing in remand-type cases, since those cases are by definition more serious criminal offenses. As to the remainder of the cases, the court stands between the juvenile and the police, exercising its discretion through consideration of whether the facts of a given case merit the rather frightening experience of mugging and printing the child. The proposed legislation would substantially remove this safeguard. Police would be allowed to take mugshots and fingerprint a child taken into temporary custody if a child is taken into custody for commission of an act which, if committed by an adult, could, and I emphasize could, constitute a felony, and a child's photograph or fingerprints are needed to complete the investigation of a crime. The Metropolitan Youth Commission respectfully submits that this provision grants to the police absolute and unconditional discretion to mug and print virtually any child taken into custody on suspicion of commission of a crime. It is noteworthy that this provision does not allow the juvenile court to make a finding that there exists reasonable grounds to believe the juvenile has committed a crime. Police are given the responsibility of deciding whether the act or acts in question could conceivably constitute a felony, and whether the photograph or fingerprints are needed to complete the investigation of a crime, not the crime in question. An inevitable consequence of such provision would be to give the police a handy tool for imposition of third degree upon the child. Note also that a crime includes any crime and not necessarily the crime in question. The Portland Police Bureau has frankly acknowledged that one of the primary purposes of the proposed change is to clean up their unsolved case files. The Bureau has further conceded that the police, not the courts, would be making the probable cause determination under this provision. Probable cause is a legal term of art that has historically been determined by the courts on a case-by-case basis utilizing classic 20/20 hindsight. Since there's adequate provision for this determination by the juvenile court with consequent safeguards under the present law, the Metropolitan Youth Commission feels that the proposed change is not warranted. Since much stress has been laid on expunction and confidentiality to justify this bill, I'd just like to point out a few things about the expunction statute. First of all, according to a survey that was conducted by the Metropolitan Youth Commission and submitted to the interim committee this summer, expunction procedures are not used in many parts under the current law. Expunction procedures are not used in many parts of the state. And changes under Senate Bill 2, Article 17, would eliminate the automatic expunction provision, which was discussed in earlier testimony. Although expunction is designed to take the sting and stigma out of procedures such as fingerprinting, it does not do so now in many areas state, and it is my estimation that it's less likely to do so if Article 17 is enacted. Function currently, according to a survey that we conducted this past summer under the current law, is not enforced in many areas of the state. The automatic expunction procedures specifically are not used in certain areas, and it is my personal estimation that Article 17, which is the proposed changes in the expunction law, which eliminates automatic expunction altogether, is passed, but it will be less likely to protect young people from stigma.
Well, on the way it is now, you mean in some areas of the state they just kind of don't get around to it?
Yeah.
But
there's, I guess there's a degree of prejudice against the statute. There's no really good, as I guess it was discussed this summer, there's no really good explanation as to why they're not doing it since it's law. But in fact, according to our survey, it's not employed in areas of the state.
Well, who did you get your information from in your survey?
Our survey was conducted at the juvenile department. No, juvenile departments. Some of them were submitted directly from the director, and others were from other people in the juvenile department who
and
worked with expunging.
And people who were working there said they weren't expunging?
Correct.
Good question. Thank you very much. Darlene Anderson?
Pauline Anderson, I represent the ACLU of Oregon.
Sorry, go ahead.
Perfect, all right. The ACLU of Oregon is opposed to relaxing the restrictions of current statute on the fingerprinting and photographing of a child in custody. Current law allows for necessary fingerprinting and photographing with consent of the court or in cases where the child is remanded to criminal court. It effectively places the court between the child and an unnecessary invasion of privacy. A telephone poll of juvenile court judges in Multnomah and Washington counties indicates that none of them has ever denied a request for fingerprinting and photographing of juveniles, which was properly drawn. Representative Marsh quoted Stevie Remington, and I'll restate that quote, perhaps with a little more elaboration. Two public defenders who have handled about 1,000 adult cases, and we realize adult cases may be different than juvenile cases in this regard, between them estimated that fingerprints were a factor in only 10 of them out of 1,000 and were introduced as evidence in the trial of only one. We feel that the need for this investigative tool has not been adequately shown. Provision in the proposed legislation for expunction of fingerprints and photographs along with files and records is a creditable gesture, but in fact, few juveniles bother to have their records expunged. The record, therefore, remains with the possible presumption of guilt when he may never have been found guilty. The ACLU feels that the inconvenience of properly requesting consent of the court for fingerprinting and photographing of juveniles is minor when weighed against a child's right to privacy and the presumption of innocence. I'd like to comment a little bit about Detective Font's testimony that it certainly makes it easier to thumb through files of fingerprints to find someone that, one whose fingerprint matches the one that they've collected. It certainly does expedite police work. If our only concern were expediting police work, I suppose this would fingerprinting everybody who came in would be something that we would approve of. But we're also concerned with juvenile confidentiality and protection. Ms. Welch said that the photographs that you asked about were used for a series of pictures for identification purposes. This we would also consider to be unacceptable, where a series of photographs are presented. Is this the kid? Is this the kid? Is this the kid? As throwdowns, we would find this unacceptable.
If we had the expungement section tightened up to where the only class of fingerprints that they were going to be looking through were kids who had been convicted of felonies, or whatever the juvenile word euphemisms are, convicted of felonies. So that's the class you're dealing with. Do you feel that's unnecessary invasion of their right to privacy?
No. I think probably you would not feel that way.
So if we tightened up the expungement and had it automatic, and so that if the kid was adjudicated not guilty or whatever, that we'd not...
That doesn't answer the relaxing of the current statute that we opposed also. Of the consent of the court necessary to do the fingerprinting and photographing in the first place.
Chairman, I note that your statement says that a few juveniles bother to have their records expunged. I'm assuming that every juvenile has the right to counsel provided to him by his own expense or by the state.
Under what condition?
Well, if he were arrested for a felony under this bill, he would have the right to counsel. Is that correct?
I guess so. I don't know that.
Well, whose fault is it that his record is not expunged? Maybe we ought to tighten up the bar exam. And of course, the other question I have, you know, there isn't anyone that I know of who is more concerned, certainly this group, about charging someone with a felony and found not guilty, and that there be some stigma attached to it. The other problem, which seems more apparent, is the fact that crime is about, especially in Multnomah County, where obviously more of the criminals exist than other places. But there seems to me to be a real problem, and how do you help Multnomah County take care of this problem, as well as the rest of the state? And there ought to be some room, it seems to me, in the American Civil Liberties Union for a method take care of that person who is charged erroneously so that he does not have any criminal record and yet assist in what we see as a tremendous criminal increase. There's no way that we can find room, in your opinion, to do that?
It's certainly something that would be a legitimate sort of study, I would say.
Well,
I mean, we're not against apprehending criminals, convicting criminals.
I know you're not.
Yes, I realize you know that.
And yet, you know, here we are. We're talking about those arrested for felonies only. Yes,
they're just arrested for felonies.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess I have a question. Detective Font says that these fingerprints are kept on file, the photographs are kept on file. If they're expunged, Would the whole file be expunged, or just the kids' file? I gather that these are kept in a general file for identification purposes in general, not necessarily in the kids' file. Would those also be expunged at the time of the expungement of the?
Well, I assume the whole record is destroyed when you talk about expungement.
I would assume that, also. But that has not been.
Well, I don't. Whoever wrote me, I also have my Ku Klux Klan card.
I got my new Republican sustaining membership card.
I need all the help we can get.
Senator Brown.
Just a brief question. First, is it my understanding that you indicated that the ACLU would favor the fingerprinting and photographing of a child who had been adjudicated by juvenile court as guilty of an offense which, if committed by an adult, would constitute a felony?
If he's admitted to criminal court, this is...
That's the current
statute,
yes. Current law. What if he's been found guilty by the juvenile court for an act which, if committed by an adult, would be a felony?
If he's found guilty?
By the juvenile court for an act which, if committed by an adult, would have been a felony.
Your question is, then is it all right to fingerprint and,
yes,
and photograph him,
yes,
at the time of
following conviction?
Following conviction? I'd have to consult my...
Would you? I'd be interested.
Would
that,
I personally?
No. Would you?
I will consult the...
And when they're pulling the ACLU membership, they might call me.
Well, it's usually just the board that makes these momentous decisions. So.
Further
question.
In the last question. We had a bill in the last session which passed the Senate and died in Representative Magruder's Judiciary Committee, dealing with the photographing of an abused child. This, of course, has to do with the battered child syndrome, and again, attempting to protect the child. Not here by generating the reluctance to commit crime, but maybe reluctance on the part of his parents to further abuse him. Now, I gather that the ACLU is opposed to this entire bill. This bill also includes that protection here in line 15.
No, we would not oppose that.
You support that provision as well.
I gather that there is another bill to take care of that, and we would support that.
Are there any other provisions of this bill that you support?
No.
Thank you very much. If you'll turn to Senate Bill 21, please. Mr. Fitch.
21.
Yes.
I'm Sergeant Swain.
Hi. Came down to say hello to my neighbor.
Good.
We got the kids off of the mountain.
All right.
Good.
You state your name for the record, sir.
Senator, I'm Sergeant Hugh Sweeney. I'm with the Clackamas County Sheriff's Office in Oregon City.
Go ahead.
I'm down representing Sheriff John Renfro, who was sworn in last week as sheriff in Clackamas County. I might mention to the committee that Sheriff Renfro, in the past 10 years prior to being elected sheriff, was with the juvenile department in our county and is very much aware of the processes and the juvenile code. He has asked me to indicate to you his support of Senate Bill 3. I also am appearing today after 13 years in law enforcement and as a law school graduate, so I'm a little familiar with that phase of it too. I'm going to speak today on just one phase of it, which has been mentioned before, and that's the value that we in law enforcement see as an investigative tool only. Some other elements have been discussed already by other witnesses, and I want to just cite a couple of cases that I think might point out to the committee why we feel it is so important.
As you're aware, as you've already heard again today, there's a significant percentage of the crime in this country and in this state which is committed by juveniles, particularly in the area of burglary and auto theft. And I want to decide a case to you today as to why I personally have some feelings about this. On January 2nd of this year, I investigated a burglary, an attempted burglary, of a summer home on Mount Hood. And after we'd worked on that for some time, it's pretty well established that there were two 17-year-old juveniles who were probably responsible. Both have previous records for burglary. 1 week later, the same house was burglarized in a similar manner. They made a successful burglary at that time, and the loss was $15,000. On the second burglary, we obtained some excellent fingerprints, but we are not able to match them with anybody at this point. I think clearly the availability of the fingerprints from these two 17-year-olds who have previous records would hasten the investigation, and if they are the correct people, it would provide hard physical evidence at the time of the hearing. We feel that I'd like to respond, if I might, Senator, to a couple of the comments that I heard earlier. One is that I hope that the committee and no one in this room draws any conclusions about effective law enforcement from television programs. I'm the first to say that I'm appalled by the trash that they show as police programs. And the other thing is that after 13 years in police work, I have yet to arrest anybody on suspicion, whether they're an adult or a juvenile. You see that on television all the time where somebody is arrested for suspicion of burglary or murder. In Oregon, we don't have that particular law, so if there's any fears of that being done, it just can't be done in Oregon. The state of Oregon, and certainly because of the efforts of the legislature a few years ago in establishing the Board of Police Standards and Training, I think have created in the state of Oregon a law enforcement community, if you will, that is really second to none in the nation. And the legislature gets a lot of credit for that, and the Board of Police Standards and Training gets a lot of credit. I'm first to admit that there are times, as was mentioned here earlier, that there may be an officer in a smaller community where he does not have the wide experience of a metropolitan police department, where he may make some mistakes, but I'm satisfied in my own mind after these years of police work that, for the most part, that the police do operate properly, and I can assure you on my own behalf and the people that I work with that the civil rights of juveniles and adults are respected alike. Now, there was a time a few years ago where that was not the case until the new juvenile code did come into effect. I think that some of the fears that have been expressed today are really kind of begging a question a little bit, and we urge the support of this bill as an investigative tool. The other question that came up that I think needs to be expanded on a little bit. Clearly, if this does pass, we're not going to go out with buses and haul in all the kids in our county and fingerprint and photograph them. I envision this being a long process over the years where once a juvenile is arrested and charged with a felony, that it is proper to have fingerprints, and that they, of course, it's going to take time to build up the files. We certainly are not saying that we're going to round up every kid that we think is a bad kid and a wholesale fingerprinting of the juvenile population in our county. This is the beginning of an investigative tool that will be available to policemen in the future, just as it was when we began fingerprinting adults years ago. So, if there are any questions, I would try to answer them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senate Bill 21.
Madam Chairman and members of the committee, I'm appearing simply to present to the committee testimony which has been prepared by one of our cooperating attorneys. And it's printed, and I've given it to the clerk. I don't intend to make a statement. However, if yourself or any members of the committee would like to contact the ACLU about this testimony, I am available here at the Capitol as an intern, and of course you can also call our office in Portland. So with that, I'll
Any questions?
We have some quick questions.
Is it before us, Karen? Is his testimony?
His testimony should be SB-21 written right out there, ACLU.
You better tell us about it, because otherwise nobody, or at least especially me, will ever read it. So why don't you tell us what's in your testimony?
It's
Well, I would have to, if I was going to undertake that, I'd have to apologize, because I'm not, I don't have any background in this area. I'm not a lawyer. I can go ahead and read this, but I certainly wouldn't be able to give any kind of intelligent response to any specific questions you might have. So, would you like me to go ahead and read the testimony? Or?
Are you ready to respond to questions?
No, I'm not.
All right. Thank you very much for coming. Senate Bill 161, Mr. Ruff.
Jay Ruff from the Department of Motor Vehicles, and as I indicated before, I haven't had an opportunity to really prepare for a great deal of testimony on this bill. I would like to read from our rationale on the assumptions as to why we ask that the bill be introduced. This measure would confirm confidentiality of medical reports from doctors and the State Board of Health, medical disorders of an individual, and any such information on driving records. This information is confidential under ORS 42-141, but an opinion by the Attorney General's office has stated that the public records law in effect repealed the provisions of 482-141. The reports received by the division will be used only to determine whether the individual is qualified to operate a motor vehicle upon the highways in the state. And the reports would only be submitted, according to our assumption, to the doctor who submitted them, or to the person named in the report with the written consent of the doctor who submitted the report. But only for the purpose of clarifying existing statutes that the bill has been introduced.
What does 482-141 say?
Would you like to have me read it?
If you have a copy of that statute in the material, your last page of your good office material is 482-141.
Now, why do you say this bill is necessary?
Well, it is current statute under 42-141 that it is confidential. Now, but an AG's opinion that was rendered in 1974 apparently indicates that it is not, that it's repealed by the public records law.
We had trouble finding the bill, and you might elucidate a little further.
Madam Chairman?
Yes, Senator Cook.
I wonder if our clerk could check to find out if this would be a good place to put in an amendment to prohibit the disclosure of driving records to insurance companies.
I'd like to, seriously, I think that it's just criminal what the insurance companies are doing to people. And I think we might accomplish that at the same time. And what I'd like, I'd appreciate if the clerk could prepare some amendments to this bill that would prohibit the disclosure of any driving records to insurance companies except those involving convictions of DUIL, reckless driving. the majors, that they not allow them to have any of the other records. This might be a good place to deal with that. Could she check into that for us?
Yes.
I think if more people are unfairly discriminated against by the insurance industry in the name of these, what I think is the reason I mention it now, that's what I'm thinking about. I don't think they can defend statistically the way they're doing it. I'd like the person to come before this committee and try to prove to us that they really have, there's any statistical value in the method they're using to increase rates unfairly for thousands of organs.
Mr. Rupp, do you know where that statute, well, what's the number of that statute that prohibits your giving out information on feeding violence?
ORS 46056. The statute relating to the exceeding maximum speed laws, the fuel conservation laws, 484735, I believe, or 775.
Now that's the maximum, that's the fuel conservation law.
Right.
Which one did you just give us?
ORS 486056.
Yeah, which shouldn't be in effect at all now, except we've got a Department of Transportation that doesn't believe in the law. Now, what's the one that allows the insurance companies to get our driving records? What statute is that under?
This is under 486056, provides for the department to send records to companies relating to the individual's driving record.
486056.
Senator Wire, you have this statute here, the bill and the statute to the confidential records, and you have the statute before you. In your
house,
so put together the last name. Now, if you go briefly once again through why you want 482141, just briefly, please.
We presently have the authority under 482141. To consider this information confidential. However, an attorney general's opinion, which was rendered in 1974, and the opinion number is 7103,
and it says what?
That this opinion has the general effect of the public records law of repealing the provisions of 482141.
This is a peremptory challenge in a criminal suit?
Right. Restrict it to 12 per trial instead of per offense.
Twelve for trial. Tell us what it does now. Would you tell us?
Well, some courts are giving 12 peremptories per offense charge. And this bill allows only 12 peremptories per trial. So if there's multiple offenses, you might have 36 peremptories or something in some courts.
That is, the law is ambiguous, and there's two interpretations. And the judge then feel the better interpretation is the 12 per trial, but it's more practical.
Yes. I'm using his name loosely. I
appreciate that. I moved that out with a new pass.
Madam Chairman, it's awfully early. Why don't we put out, I don't have this kind of trial, but most people don't even know this bill is here. They don't, very few, if anybody, probably started receiving their bill. And I would suggest, Madam Chairman, that we maybe set it for action in a couple of weeks and maybe give notice that we're going to take action to give people who represent people accused of crimes an opportunity to come in here. Now, Judge Lane is a fine lawyer and an excellent judge, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But there are a lot of people around that have a whole lot more experience on representing people accused of crimes than anybody on this panel of legislators. So I'd request we could wait a couple of weeks and give them a chance to find out the bill is here before we vote it out of committee.
Senator, you send it out? All right. Anything further to come before
the Senate? I wanted to vote for Senator Lane one time.
I'll probably vote for it later, but there may be, we don't have anybody here that's probably ever heard, knows anything about it. With all due respect to all of us lawyers who have probably never tried anything more serious than a petty theft.